Hello, everyone. I am Paul Phillips, the IT Risk Practice Lead for ISACA. And I'm excited today because we are having the first of its kind, if I'm not mistaken, a joint roundtable with the FAIR Institute, as well as with CERA, two very, very accomplished organizations in the field of risk management. And we are joined today by representatives from both of those organizations, as well as a representative from ISACA. So I wanted to start by allowing each of our panelists and roundtable members to introduce themselves. But let me first say this is not a presentation. It is, in fact, a discussion between these experts in these particular fields. So let me start by asking Jack Jones, if you will introduce yourself.
Hi, yes, thank you. Jack Jones, Chief Risk Scientist for RiskLens and Chairman of the FAIR Institute. I've been in technology for almost 40 years now and information security and risk management for over 35 years. I've been a CISO for three different companies, and I'm the originator of the FAIR risk analysis model.
Great. Awesome. And Jack, tell us a little bit more about the FAIR Institute, if you can.
The FAIR Institute is a nonprofit, community-focused organization that's intended to help the profession continue to advance its practices, specifically through the application of FAIR and quantitative methods.
Great.
We have currently almost 12,000 members globally.
Great. Thank you, Jack. Next, we have Tony Martin-Vaig. Tony, would you introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi. Thank you for that introduction, Paul. My name is Tony Martin-Vaig, and I work at Netflix on the quantitative cyber risk management team. The usual disclaimers apply. I'm here representing myself and not my employer. I'm also on the CIRA Board of Directors. That's the Society of Information Risk Analysts. We're a really small and scrappy organization. It's all volunteer. And our main mission and goal is advancing risk management techniques, and in particular, quantitative risk management techniques. We have many FAIR users in CIRA, as well as people that use other quantitative risk management techniques. I've been in technology about 20 years, with the last 10 of those in the risk management field, specifically quantitative risk. I built several quantitative risk management programs for a few different companies, and I am really excited to be here with everyone.
Great. Thank you, Tony. And next we have Evan Wheeler. Evan, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. Evan Wheeler. I'm a VP of risk management at a small fintech startup called Endeavor, and I've spent the last 25 years doing technology and cybersecurity and risk management across a number of different organizations. I've built around five different enterprise risk and operational risk and IT risk programs over the last few years. And here today, I'm representing ISACA. We've got a great IT risk working group where we're putting out a lot of really great resources that I hope all of you will take advantage of.
Thank you, Evan. So let's just jump right in. We have a number of questions. And again, this is a discussion. So I'll ask one of you a question and then allow the others to chime in, if you will. So I want to start with you, Jack. So one of the questions I want to ask is, what is CRQ? We hear that term and that acronym a lot. So what is CRQ and why is it important?
It's a great question because there's a lot of confusion in the industry about what cyber risk quantification is and isn't. And what it really boils down to, it's simply the measurement of loss exposure related to cyber events. And, you know, unlike qualitative measurement, as you would imagine, this is being measured in economic terms, probabilities and magnitudes of loss in monetary terms. So So that's really what it is. Again, it's measurement in economic terms rather than colors or words or one through five ordinal scales, those sorts of things. And this is really important for a number of reasons, and I could use up our whole time talking about the reasons I believe it's important, but I'll boil it down to just three. The first is, you know, it allows us to much more reliably identify and focus on the things that matter most in our organizations. Because when you're measuring qualitatively, those measurements tend to be so imprecise and unreliable that it's way too easy to misprioritize and focus on things that really are not that important or miss things that really are important. So that's the first. The second reason is it enables ROI, you know, return on investment calculations for what we spend our resources on. And because every organization has limited resources, you know, being able to understand the value you're getting for your investments in terms of, you know, reduction in risk is incredibly helpful. And I know many organizations that have used CRQ to evaluate a proposed expenditure and go, no, you know, really, really, it's not worth the money. And of course, in many other cases, you know, it allows them to explain and defend investments to their CFOs and other business executive stakeholders. So that ROI support is incredibly important. And then the last is it allows us to speak to our executive stakeholders in a language that they are familiar with and understand, and it puts them in a much better position from a decision-making perspective because, you know, they think, you know, they tend to focus on revenue and cost containment. You know, and those are obviously in economic terms. And then we come to the table with red, yellow, green, or high, medium, low, or one through five scales. And we place them immediately at a disadvantage because they're having to make trade-offs and choices and decisions between very unlike things, you know, these colors versus the economic terms that they're used to dealing with. So by bringing with us these economic terms to explain you know, the position of the organization or a rationale for recommendations and such, they're in a much better position to make appropriate trade-offs.
So let me ask this question, and Evan, you can kind of respond to this. So given what Jack just said, we're talking about risk quantifications, and I believe I heard you say, Jack, that when using qualitative analysis, it's way too easy to miss important attributes. So Evan, my question to you is there any room for risk qualitative analysis? If we're going to adopt risk quantification, is there any room for those organizations that have been using risk qualitative analysis for years?
Yeah, the short answer is there definitely is room for it. It's not a throw out everything you've been doing and start from scratch kind of scenario. The longer version of that, as I think about it, is that there is some value to qualitative assessments, but I think we need to understand how they should be used and where quantitative measurements can help do all those things that Jack was talking about helping our stakeholders make better decisions. Where I think people get into trouble is they try to use qualitative rankings or labels or descriptions of things to measure and aggregate risks, which is really not what it's intended for. Fundamentally, I really think about qualitative assessments as understanding attributes of a risk. How different scenarios are similar or different. If you want to put different risk scenarios into categories or buckets of things, they can be useful for that. And those assessments can help you understand those attributes of different scenarios. But you can't really truly measure risk exposure or aggregate multiple risk scenarios using qualitative scales that people might be used to. So, you know, you might ask yourself, well, then what does that mean for all my qualitative risk frameworks? Well, I think they just need to evolve, but they don't need to be thrown out altogether. A common approach that I've seen is to split your framework between the methods used to measure risk and the ways you communicate risk. And this can be a good bridge from your existing format of what people are used to trying to build something that's more defensible. You can introduce quantitative measurements techniques in parallel, essentially, with your current qualitative assessments. Compare the results, you know, use this to challenge some of your assumptions. This could happen all in the background without stakeholders even needing to, you know, see your work. Then get them hooked on the results and the better insights that it gives them into that decision making. And start out by using some of the same reporting formats that they're already familiar with. Then once you feel confident in your quantitative measurement techniques, slowly introduce the quantitative elements into your reporting as well. But it doesn't have to be like this big bang approach where you just like one day shut everything off that you had before and create something that's totally new. I've really found that the most effective place to start in a lot of cases is gathering data around your own incidents and your incident management process. You know, start measuring the impact of your actual loss events, the actual incidents and the impacts that you're having to your organization. This can provide a really good basis to map some of those qualitative rankings that you're using before into quantitative ranges, at least for impact. And then, you know, you can evolve that into the probability or frequency side of things too, as you mature. And then, you know, maybe look at another area of your program, like risk acceptances. Try reevaluating some of the risks that stakeholders have already signed off on, which kind of already nice contained scenarios, and use a quantitative measure. And again, just kind of see how different the result is and what insights you get. And you can kind of ease the organization into this transition slowly and sometimes in the background until you have some success to kind of show off. And I know this is kind of a bottom-up approach. Certainly, if you have the executive support, you might want to do more of a top-down approach, which is going to look a little bit different. You might want to find a really important question that the organization is grappling with, or a decision of an investment or something like that, and see how you can help them answer that one question using quantitative measures. And then I think the key to it is get some successes and then, you know, evangelize those and get some other people on board that they can help evangelize as well.
Awesome. That's interesting. So I hear you saying get some successes, communicate with senior management and the board of directors in a way that they're used to, by possibly using qualitative attributes while doing a quantitative analysis in the background. That's interesting, and slowly transition the organization to risk quantification. So Jack, what are your thoughts on that? Is there any room for qualitative analysis when starting with quantitative approaches?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, there is. And actually, when I first began using FAIR as a risk measurement approach, we did very much what Evan described. We kept the quantitative sort of in the background. We translated the results into qualitative buckets, right? They were defined as these quantitative values would, you know, falling within this bucket versus that bucket. And we would communicate to the executives with those, with the colors they were used to. And even with that, I mean, besides being a simpler transition, because we were able to use the better risk measurement methods behind the covers, we reduced by an order of magnitude the number of high-risk issues in the organization because, as I mentioned earlier, we were just much better able to compare the different problems we faced. And so as a communication tool, qualitative can work fine in many, many instances. But, you know, it has its limitations. But, it, you know, I agree wholeheartedly with what Evan said.
Awesome. So Tony, say we decide to adopt a risk quantification approach after doing qualitative analysis, the qualitative approach for years. So talk to an organization, maybe especially those that are in a small to medium enterprise organizations. How do we get started? What are some of the data points we need to collect? And what are some of the steps that need to be taken to transition to risk quantification?
I think that's a great question because there's so many myths and misconceptions around getting your program started and collecting the right data points. I think an important first step in building out your quantitative program is identifying those people within your company that can not only help you gather the right data, but also consumers of your data. You're going to be producing reports that drives a lot more conversations, in-depth conversations that maybe your audience isn't accustomed to, because with red, yellow, green, you're really bounded by the types of discussions you can have. It's really risk ranking. I'm going to do all my reds first and then my mediums, and we're going to hold on the greens. When you switch over to a quantitative risk program, you're going to discover that the conversations you have around risk are a lot more robust and in-depth. So you really want to identify those folks within your company who will consume that data. I think that both Jack and Evan have great points around risk communication, of how you identify the people that consume the reports and how you present that information to them. One thing that I've found in many companies that I've worked at is my peers and some of my key stakeholders within my information security teams or operational risk teams, we need to take baby steps to get them accustomed to consuming quantitative risk analysis. But if you skip level, if you take a level up and you go up to those C-suite people, I've found that they immediately are able to consume those quantitative risk results. People that have a background in finance, business, maybe they have an MBA, they've taken a couple classes in economics in college, statistics, insurance, making decisions using numbers like probability and currency, it's second nature to those folks. And they're much more able to understand those results than some of my peers. So that would be probably my best and first advice for folks, is to find those folks within your company that that can consume this data. You're going to be building bridges and making allies along the way. And then to the, to your data question, data collection is a really important step in any risk analysis, whether it's qualitative or quantitative, like FAIR. Not collecting data at all is a fatal flaw that I think many risk analysts make. Like when you're doing something like red, yellow, green, you can ask five people, yeah, it feels red. You're not collecting any data. You're just picking a color. Something like FAIR or other cyber risk quantification frameworks out there, they can help you start to overcome this problem. FAIR itself provides a really good methodology and framework for taking different data sources and bringing it into your analysis. And what I really want to emphasize with people here is you can just use what you already have access to. Mm-hmm. You have a ton of internal data sources. You might not think of them as risk data, but a lot of it can be used. Incident reports, like what you might have in JIRA or your ticketing program, internal audits, pen testing, vuln scans, BCP reports, that kind of thing. I also heavily lean on external data sources, sometimes even more than internal data sources. I look at what type of incidents my competitors have had, or companies that are using a similar technology stack, similar geographic footprint, similar company size. There's a ton of information out there just on Google News. It's a great source to inform both the frequency and the magnitude of events that happen at your company. I look at external incident lists, SEC filings, as I mentioned, Google News, great places. And then last and probably most important is experts. You have one of the tools for probably the best form of data collection right at your fingertips. All of you have this, and that's experts, people that work at your company. With a little bit of training, you can teach those experts to encode their beliefs quantitatively. So instead of saying, I think data breach is red or high, you can train them to say, I think the data breach, data breach incident will happen every, between once every 10 years and once every 15 years, as an example. And with that, you're using the wisdom of crowds phenomena. You're gathering a lot of people. The more people you get, they cancel out each other's biases. And it can be a very credible, defensible, and in some cases faster and cheaper way to get data. And remember that when you're doing risk measurement, it's a forecast. Humans at this point are really the best tool we have to offer up conjecture about the future and how things may change, how the threat landscape might change, how the control environment might be failing, but it's not reflected yet in historical data. And you can take all of those data sources I just mentioned and combine them all into a credible estimate for use in a cyber risk quantification analysis.
Yeah, Tony, you mentioned some really good concepts there. You kind of alluded to understanding the frequency, the likely frequency of maybe a risk taking place by talking to the experts. You mentioned the fact that you need to understand those experts that rely on that information and historical data, as well as external data, are all datas that data points or data sets, rather, that should be considered. So I want to go to Evan and kind of ask the question. For purposes of this discussion, we're talking to an organization that may have limited resources because they're a smaller organization or a medium-sized organization versus a very large outfit. How would you approach or advise those organizations to start to adopt risk quantification? So I guess my question is there a difference in the approaches?
Yeah, I think every company is going to be a little different based on where you're at and what problem you're going to try to solve. I'm a big believer in picking the solution that meets the problem, which means you have to kind of understand what the pain points are rather than coming with a solution and trying to find the problem that fits it. So every organization is going to be a little bit different in that way. But what I've seen across companies of different sizes and different profiles is, I think risk appetite or risk tolerance, whatever you want to call it, is a good core core of the framework for people to really understand. And it can be something as simple as how long can the service be down for our clients or unavailable or something like that, and start to have a discussion about that and start to get a feeling for people's comfort levels there and what things would kind of kick in. And that starts to give you more data, to Tony's point before, about potential impacts and where people might be passing a threshold that can inform your metrics and your assessment priorities and all those kinds of things. But you really have to understand what's important to the organization, what types of impact are going to be the most painful and get the most attention. So you can kind of cater your measurement and your program to those areas, or it may be a strategy that your company has or your organization has. It's really important to keep all of our risk activities very closely aligned with the strategies and the objectives of the organization. And maybe the company is trying to expand into a new part of the globe or start a new service. That's where I would focus my risk quantification and measurement activities of how can I provide them more insights into how we, what risks there may be to us not succeeding in these objectives. And that could be something like a new initiative process, or it could take the form of some kind of investment decision that they're trying to make. But, you know, find those areas that people really care about and are pain points, and focus your efforts there. And don't worry about kind of having all the components of some big framework or some big program. You know, size it and tailor it to you know, what your organization needs at the time.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So it's not a one size fits all, but kind of look at the risk appetite, as you said, the risk tolerance of the organization, the long-term business objective of the organization, and approach it from that perspective. That's really good. So I want to go ahead.
If I could just add one thing that I was thinking of when Jack and Tony were talking, the other thing is just to warn people that there's a lot of room to hide in qualitative assessments of things. Mm-hmm. And when you put a quantitative assessment in front of people, human nature is they challenge it in ways they never challenge the qualitative conclusions that you have. So just be prepared for that. People are going to ask you questions they never bothered to ask before, and they're going to dig deeper than they ever would if you had just told them something was red. And that seems to be a universal reaction.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. He's absolutely right. The first times you put quantitative analysis results in front of executive stakeholders, they will ask questions, and so you want to make sure you've done your homework. But they're not asking questions they shouldn't be asking of qualitative. It's just the qualitative, God knows why, tends to go unchallenged unless there's some debate over how much money you're proposing to spend on something. You should, whether you're doing qualitative or quantitative, to Tony's point and to Evan's point, you should have done your homework. You should have collected data. You should be able to defend those results in some way other than, well, because it feels this way to me, or because, you know, everybody knows it's red, you know, so... Yeah, you should do your homework regardless of whether you're doing qualitative or quantitative, but you will encounter more questions early on when you're doing quantitative. But the great thing about that is, if you've done your homework, after you've had a few of those discussions, those questions tend to trail off, and you don't tend to get them as often. And my experience, at least, is you will have gained a tremendous amount of credibility and the perception that, hey, you know, you actually do understand the business. You are doing your homework and those sorts of things. So I've found nothing but benefit from those questions. Again, as long as you do your homework.
That's good. That's good. So, well, let me ask a follow-up question. Do you feel, you used the term, Evan, is easier to hide when you're doing qualitative. Is that because of the subjective nature of qualitative analysis, whereas quantitative is more objective? And I guess the second part of that is, to Jack's point, does that encourage more questions when it's a qualitative approach from leaders of the organization?
Yeah, I think, like Jack said, it's not something to be discouraged by, but it is something to be prepared for. So if you imagine going to a senior management meeting or a board meeting, and you say that this event is likely to happen often, everybody is going to interpret that often in their own way, and chances are they're going to make it match their mental model of how often they thought that was going to happen. And it'll kind of resonate with them, and they'll move on and they won't challenge it. If you say it's likely to happen once every 2 years, that gives them less ambiguity. And now they have to challenge all their assumptions, and they start to wonder, well, why not once every 3 years? Why every 2 years? And I think people just start to ask more questions about how did you come up with that? Who did you involve? Did you look at this data? Is this representing the whole organization or just one business unit? And to Jack's point, those are the questions you absolutely want them to be asking, but they never asked them before. So you sure. just really have to be prepared for it and try to use that as an opportunity to highlight how much better insight you can give them. And you don't want to go with super detailed quantitative analysis, you know, the guts behind all of it in your presentation, but you sure want to have that at the ready to back it up as people ask questions and you can refer back to things to answer them and make them feel comfortable that the right people were involved and that the data is credible and that you were thinking about it in a structured way.
All good points. All good points. So let me ask then, and I actually would love for all three of you to respond, but I'll start with Tony. What is, in your experience, what are some of the biggest hurdles that an organization typically encounters when adopting a risk quantification approach?
Some of the initial hurdles are getting over the myths and mythologies and misconceptions around cyber risk quantification. I think that there's this idea that cyber risk quantification is new and it hasn't been time tested. And, you know, if you're a company that's trying to move to it, we're an early adopter or something like that. I've heard that many times, when in actuality, the, you know, the underlying equations and the techniques and the reasons for doing it have been around for hundreds of years. Other fields don't call it cyber risk quantification. You know, they just call it risk analysis or risk because other fields just use numbers. For some reason in business risk, including cyber risk, you know, two decades ago, we started using these colors. We broke away from other risk management fields that have been using these equations and methodologies and models for a very long time. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest hurdles initially is getting over this idea that we're doing something new and hasn't been tested. And probably the other big misconception or hurdle would be data, where to get the data, which I covered in the previous answer, and so did Evan and Jack. And also just consuming data. Some people have a hard time consuming numbers. Other people can look at numbers right away and completely understand it and are able to interpret it. So with that, I would advise everybody to just try to meet your audience where you're at. Sit with them and figure out, learn how they consume data. For some people, you're always going to be presenting a heat map. You're always going to be taking your underlying data and converting it into colors, which is fine. And there's other audience members who want to see the underlying data and a loss exceedance curve and your 10th percentile number and your 90th percentile, and just have that ready for those folks too. So that would be really my best advice of how to get over some of those initial hurdles.
Yeah, those are good. Jack, Evan, in your experiences, what are some of the biggest hurdles companies have experienced in adopting risk quantification?
I'll double click, so to speak, on one of the myths that Tony, mentioned. And that is, there seems to be this obsession or this belief that quantitative measurements of risk need to be precise, right? We need to have, no uncertainty in these numbers. And that's just simply not true. And it's actually kind of ridiculous when you think about, revenue forecasts and those sorts of things are never precise. They're always ranges. And any, quantitative measurement in any complex dynamic problem space is going to involve ranges and distributions and imprecision and uncertainty. And that is part and parcel with risk measurement and should be understood. And there are, to Tony Evans' points too about, the methods and techniques used in cyber risk quantification are not new. They've been around for a long, long time in disciplines that are also complex and dynamic and have a lot of uncertainty. And it's just accepted fact that there will be uncertainty and imprecision in the measurements and in the results. And that is something I encounter just over and over again in our industry as one of sort of the roadblocks that people and, in fact, entire departments or organizations stumble over, is this expectation that these measurements should be precise and have no uncertainty in them. And so that causes organizations and people to either not engage in it at all, or to go and spend inordinate and unrealistic amounts of time trying to chase perfect data, right? And it's just not necessary. And there, a friend of mine and a luminary in the field of measurement, Douglas Hubbard, has a marvelous book out there on how to measure anything. And one of the things he talks about and provides great examples of is diminishing returns on more data. I mean, the most valuable data you will gather are the first data, right? The more data you collect, that's great, but you're getting diminishing returns on reduction of uncertainty. And so people just need to understand that and embrace the fact that there's uncertainty and imprecision in this and leverage the techniques for dealing with it, which are well established.
Yeah.
One thing I'd add to that I think is a common lesson learned of areas where people fail in rolling out these programs is they don't spend enough time on scoping. And they underappreciate how important scoping can be to the process. So take an example, people will often ask me something along the lines of, how do you do a quantitative assessment of malware attacks? And my flippant answer is you don't. That's too broad of a concept to possibly do it. You need to break it down into knowable scenarios and assess those scenarios and in the context. And the more time you spend on getting the scoping right, the less painful the analysis process will be. And it's really worth the upfront effort. I'll put in a plug for ISACA here. The Risk Practitioner's Guide has a great resource of scenarios. I think something like 100 different scenarios that you can take and you can use within your own organization. I think it's a great resource for people who are trying to figure out like how big of a bite to bite off when they're trying to do these quantitative assessments. And don't try to do like a enterprise-wide every risk, assessment all at once as your first time out of the gate. It's just not going to be successful. You want to take something that's really tangible and well scoped and go and tackle that and get some lessons learned from it and, apply those to the next scenario.
Yeah. Awesome. So let me see if I could sum this up, and you guys are the experts. Keep me honest here. So you want to start with a scenario. Especially from a coping perspective, identify specific scenarios. And then I think what I've heard you guys are saying is we're attempting to forecast. And what we want to do is forecast not exact numbers, but ranges as it relates to frequency as well as magnitude, if you will. And once we, and again, I'm oversimplifying, but once we take that approach, we could use the qualitative attributes, if you will, to communicate to the leaders of the organizations, if that's what they're comfortable with, in order to present to them what the risk exposure is for the organization.
I think that's right. But I would also say that you want to slowly move that presentation from what they might be used to something that's a little bit more sophisticated. So you might go from having a single red to saying, okay, well, now we're going to break this down into what's the most likely impact and the worst case impact, and just kind of, build from there over time so people start to understand some of the nuance and the differences between these scenarios.
Great. Well, they're telling us to wrap it up, so we had a ton more questions, so we might have to do a part two. Jack, Evan, and Tony, again, representing the FAIR Institute, Sarah, and Isaka, all experts in the field. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise. I would like to end by giving a shameless plug, if you will. We do have an actual white paper, Isaka white paper on cyber risk quantifications. And all of these gentlemen were involved in either writing or reviewing the white paper. So go to our website and download the cyber risk quantification white paper, because we go into a lot more detail on all of these concepts that were discussed today. Again, thank you so much for joining us for our first joint roundtable with these particular organizations.